أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته and welcome to any non-Muslims who may have tuned in today to Radio Ramadan 87.7 FM. Today we have a show which is part of the Today's World slot on the Radio Ramadan where we have a guest who is Brother Adnan Khan, who I will introduce shortly. Just before we bring Adnan in, just to remind the listeners that if they wish to phone in, the number is SLAW 01753 701833, or you can text SLAW to 80010, where we will endeavor to answer any questions you may have. Assalamu alaikum, Adnan.
Oh, walaikum assalam.
Just to let everyone know, the subject today that we're going to try to discuss, address. We're not sure, obviously, if we're going to get to the bottom of the issue, but we're certainly going to have a go. It's really the subject of why the Muslim world, the Muslim countries, are backward, are repressive, are have not advanced, as is the case for the rest of the world. So with that in mind, before we start, just a few words about the speaker. Brother Adnan is a writer and a thinker on Islamic issues, and he's written many things and presented many lectures on subjects such as this very subject, and also other subjects such as the credit crunch, the causes behind it, the Muslim view upon the credit crunch, and also subjects such as the energy crisis, the global energy crisis, and some of the issues surrounding that subject and how it affects the Muslim world. He's also got a website which is adnan-globalissues.blogspot.com, which you may wish to view, which expresses some of his ideas, and I'm sure you'll find it shows his qualification to embark upon such a difficult subject such as the one that we're going to try to look at today. So, Adnan, if I can just start by referring to a very famous historian by the name of Bernard Lewis, who a few years ago wrote a book entitled What Went Wrong? The Western Impact and the Middle East Response, where he basically tries to sort of like address this very issue. And he compares the Muslim world with the position it had historically. So in an interview, for example, shortly after the release of this book, he mentioned, referring to the Muslim world, he said, look, these people are not really backward people. They are highly sophisticated, intelligent people who have had great civilizations in the past and who appreciate the value of knowledge and all types of knowledge. And he says, why have they have lagged behind? This is the most agonizing question. And some of the causes he attributes to this backwardness are things such as, you know, the role of women in Muslim societies and the aversion to, you know, science and learning. For example, he says, you know, in the Muslim countries, they don't study science, they study the history of science. For example, textbooks are many, many years old. And also, you know, things like the role and the relationship of women in many Muslim countries. I mean, in Saudi Arabia, for example, you know, women aren't allowed to drive motor cars, and they have a very restrictive role away, for example, from economic life. And, you know, he attributes this as one of the causes behind the backwardness of the Muslim world. What's your view on that?
I mean, Bernard Lewis, like many other academics who have attempted to address or embark upon this a study of what's actually gone wrong with the Muslim world, why they have actually failed to develop. There are obviously many factors that have resulted in the Muslims not developing, and in his actual works he goes through a number of them. I think probably the key thing to understand is there are internal issues with the Muslims which have contributed to all these, and there are many external issues as well. And what you find, depending on what sort of leaning each academical thinker comes from, they tend to give priority to a particular set of factors. So internally, definitely if you look at the Muslims, it was Islam. Islam was the trajectory that drove development. It was the motivation that pushed many Muslims, many thinkers to study science, to study other disciplines, and to actually contribute towards them. And what we find is when the pristine understanding of Islam disappeared, we see the view towards the science has even changed. And what we see is when the Industrial Revolution happened, the view of Muslims was completely different. They viewed the Industrial Revolution in a very negative way. So this is probably the most fundamental internal issue. Externally, though, there have been a number of factors that have ensured the Muslims will never develop. We see colonialism had a big impact on the Muslim lands. We see the artificial borders that have been created by the departing colonialists. That has created a problem itself, which we still see today. We see the structures that the departing colonists left, such as the feudal landlords in many of the countries, that has stifled any type of development. We've seen throughout the 50s, 60s, and the 70s, coups and counter-coups by the West in the Muslim lands has meant that it was virtually impossible for the Muslim world to move forward in a unified direction when the leadership and the government continued to actually change. We also see international institutes such as the IMF and the World Bank, through their structural adjustment programs, they did a very good job of ensuring the Muslim world actually never moved forward. We've also seen, if you look at the Muslim lands, many of them are not actually constructed upon their strengths. We see countries that are full of mineral resources and agricultural land. The economies are focused more towards banking and finance. On top of that, we see education. If you look at the Muslim world, when we look at literacy rates, the Muslim world statistics are abysmal. So there are a combination of factors, and what Bernard Lewis has done, he has attempted to look at things from a historical perspective. So, for example, he, as you mentioned, he highlighted the role of women. If women don't partake in society, you know, half of your population has essentially withdrawn from, you know, economic life. And although this is a reality, you know, this is not because of Islam. This is really a cultural practice. We see in the era of decline, there are many concepts in Islam that have become confused in the minds of Muslims, and women is actually one of them. So there are many, many factors, and I think we need to recognize there is an internal factor, which is the Muslim understanding of Islam. But on top of that, there's a lot of external factors that would ensure that actually remain as obstacles for any development in the Muslim world.
Okay, so what you're basically saying is that it's a combination of internal factors, such as culture being intertwined with Islam, for example, where things like the role of women is, you know, women are more oppressed due to cultural reasons than anything inherent within Islam. Just on that particular point, can you give examples of how when we had, in your words, you know, a more a golden era where you say Islam was more practiced in the correct form, women were, you know, allowed to flourish? Can you give examples of that?
I mean, Muhammad Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam's wife, Khadija Radhiyallahu Anha, she was actually a businesswoman. Muhammad Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam came across her because he actually worked for her, and she was actually a very successful businesswoman. I mean, I would like to point out, you know, when it comes to science, when it comes to development, when it comes to contributing towards society, Islam actually doesn't make a distinction between men and women. If you look at the Islamic rules that push Muslims look at the signs of Allah, to look into the creation of Allah, all these ayahs, they don't actually make a distinction between men and women. So what you find really is just a cultural practice where, because of this decline in understanding Islam, we've compartmentalized how economic activity should take place, and we make a difference between men and women. Islamically, women have a contribution to make towards society. A Muslim can contribute towards scientific experiments, so can a woman. You know, Islam doesn't actually make a distinction between the two.
Right, so one could argue, well, you know, it's fine saying that in a book, but in practice, in practicality, you know, the strong often tend to dominate the weak, and, you know, men will tend to dominate women. So in your understanding of the ideal society, which is shaped along sort of like religious lines, how would one safeguard against something like that from happening vis-a-vis you know, accountability, empowering the people to, you know, account the rulers and not feel, as is the case in the current Middle East, for example, that if you try to account anyone, you know, you're likely to end up, you know, executed or in prison. How would you sort of see this fundamental right being safeguarded in a Muslim society?
I mean, what you have currently in a Muslim land is really you have a structure or a situation that was really created by the departing colonialists, where, for example, in Saudi Arabia, for long there was collaboration between the Saud family and the British in dismembering the Hijaz region from the Ottoman Khilafah. So what you find in the Muslim land generally is that the governments or the rulers, really they're only interested in maintaining their positions. They're only interested in making war for their families or their inner circle. So really for them, there is no concern for wider society. That's why there is no concept of accountability. Even where in Muslim countries where you have so-called parliaments, really it's just for show. So although Egypt has a parliament, really Hosni Mubarak controls all the levers of power. And really, there's no concept of accountability there. However, if you look at historically, and even if you look at the Islamic texts, accountability, justice is central to Islamic governance. So we have a judicial system, and a specific aspect of the judicial system which deals with disputes between the government, the ruler, or people who are delegated any action, the ruling, and the actual people. So what you find is there is precedent in the Islamic texts of accountability and a process where the ruler can be held accountable, and this ensures society moves forward. The current situation we find isn't Islamic, even if some of the rules apply certain aspects of Islam, but what you find is the absence of Islam that actually created this situation. It's not Islam which has created it.
But most of the Muslim countries call themselves Islamic. For example, the Islamic Republic of Pakistan and the Iranian regime calls itself Islamic. The Saudis call themselves Islamic. Are you saying that they are, not speaking the truth?
Oh, absolutely, they're not speaking the truth. Because if we look at their key policies, I mean, the key thing to really look at, or look at any of these rulers who call themselves so-called Islamic, is really where is the reference to Islam when it comes to key policies? So when it comes to foreign policy for Iran, we don't see a reference to the Islamic text. When we look at domestic policy for Pakistan, well, aside from the implementation of some aspects of Zaghab, what we find is really the Pakistani government is quite pragmatic dealing with its domestic economic situation. If we look at Saudi Arabia, so Saudi Arabia most certainly doesn't use Islam as a basis when it's deciding its energy policy. But if it did, then it would make sure its energy caters for the needs of its people rather than caters for the needs of American corporations. So really what you find is, really, this is just a show that we are Islamic. What you find when it comes to the key policies, in fact, most policies, what you find is there's no reference to Islam.
Right. Okay. So what you're saying is to look beyond the label and look at policies and some of the sort of key aspects of how they govern. So from what you describe, this idea of public being empowered, living in a Muslim society, does that imply that it's more like a democratic society? So is that what you're saying? It's a democratic society, really, with a notion of religion in terms of the way it conducts worships?
No, what we find in Islamic societies, we don't have a sphere where you have religion and then a whole separate sphere where you have no religion. And really, people gather together and they decide what the laws are. The basis of Islam is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, He revealed the Quran, and the Quran and the actions and the saying and the consent of Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, they become the basis upon which society is formed and how society is governed and how we actually solve problems and move forward. So we are not democratic. I must highlight here that democracy is a lot more than just an electoral vote, as many people understand across the Muslim world. What you find is democracy means that it is the people that gather together as the people that actually decide what the law should be in that particular society. As Muslims, we believe we have a basis, the Quran and the Sunnah, and from there we can derive solution, and they will actually be the laws. So what you find in our history, that is exactly what the Sahaba did and the generation after them did. We find as the lands expanded, as they come across new problems, they're the rulers, the judges, they actually referred back to the text to actually solve the problem that they actually faced. So we are not, we have no problem with voting, because voting isn't specific to the West or specific to democracy. What we have a problem is where other than the Islamic texts or the Sharia texts become a basis of governing society.
Some would argue that, you know, times have moved on now from the days of, you know, the camel and, you know, lack of technology and a lack of advancement in many areas. And now, you know, we need to keep abreast of scientific and technological advancement. And obviously the Quran doesn't really discuss all of these issues. So does that imply the Quran is should not be the only sort of reference point for a progressive modern industrial society? Is that what we're saying?
No, what we're saying is, I mean, this is the argument that many people sitting in the West raise, that really, unless you're not democratic, unless you don't believe in our values, you will never see an ounce of progress. You will never see economic development or industrial development. And what you find is, if we look historically, many civilizations have been characterized with some element of industrial and technological development. So the real question here is each civilization, does it have the necessary motivation to move people to contribute towards the sciences? And we see that there are many ayahs in the Quran that are actually pushing Muslims and people who are citizens under a khilafah to have a look at the creation of Allah, have a look at how they work, and actually make use of them and manipulate them and innovate. And so we see, for example, a simple thing like praying. For Muslims to pray, they need to work out the direction of the Qibla. This itself was a motivation of any Muslim to make a contribution towards the Qibla, the compass, to work out where the actual Qibla, the direction of prayer is. So what you find, there are many ayahs like this that are actually pushing Muslims to actually do that. So what you find, really, Islam was a trajectory that drove Muslims to actually contribute to all these areas. When the understanding of Islam became vague in the mind of Muslims, what you found was that motivation dissipated over time as well. So really, Islam is not against the sciences. In fact, Islam and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala makes it very clear that what you see around you is Allah's creation. And Allah, He pushes mankind to actually understand the creation of Allah. So therefore, there is a basic motivation in Islam to actually contribute and actually understand and move forward with the sciences. Islam most definitely is not the obstacle in this.
Okay, just coming back on something you've said a couple of times, you referred to external factors such as colonialism, which, you know, people like Bernard Lewis will refer to as scapegoating the internal problems. And he also talks in this interview, which he conducted shortly after the release of this book, that I referred to at the beginning, that there's an unspoken assumption, which is that a lot of these developing or third world countries, they are incapable of having their own elections and electing a ruler because of the lack of morality and the lack of civilization within the people and the corruption within the people. So, you know, if it's a choice between them electing their own tyrants or, you know, the West imposing sort of like favorable tyrants who are not necessarily going to govern in the interests of the people, then that's like the lesser of two evils. So how would you sort of like look at that particular view?
I mean, this really shows you how Bernard Lewis, he views the whole debate through a very corrupted lens. Well, you know, this is the colonial mentality. They can't govern themselves, so let's just go and govern them, whether they want our values or not. And really, what this actually highlights a much deeper point, which is that the West, for a very long time, has actually been unable to convince the Muslim world of their values. And I don't just mean here elections, because election isn't necessarily a Western value. What we're talking about is concepts such as democracy, concepts such as freedom, as Bernard Lewis mentioned as one of the issues that is leading to Muslims not developing. They've been unable to convince Muslims of these values. So what you're seeing now, and what you've seen for a very long time, is the Western world, under the guise of, well, we're helping you, we'll just ram it down the throats of Muslims. And each time the Muslims indicate that they haven't adopted these values, what you find is, you know, historically there's something wrong with these Muslims. Historically, you know, this is what has to be done. And what you really find is that they've actually been unable to convince the Muslim world of the actual values. You may, and that's why you find, you know, they are propping up dictators across the Muslim world who have no interest in the national interest. I mean, would the West, for example, accept a ruler who is completely linked to another country and sells out the home country? The West would never accept that. So why would you expect the Muslim world to accept that? And really, it just shows you the mentality of Bernard Lewis when he actually views this topic, that, you know, this is like a good colonialism. We're actually coming to help you by conquering you, and we will just, in some form or shape, give you our values, when really what they're doing is they're reaping our resources, and they're controlling our economies, really, where, you know, so they actually take advantage of the resources. And this is what we found historically with the British and Saudi Arabia, and with the French in the Middle East as well.
Right, okay. Obviously, that's quite a wide felt sentiment amongst many people. But obviously, there's different ways to react against that. I mean, some people obviously take, you know, a violent sort of approach, which is not sort of founded through the, you know, established understandings in Islam. And other people conduct a more intellectual approach whereby issues are debated and discussed, and, you know, the relevant evidences from the legislative sources of Islam are brought to defend the position. So how would you convince somebody who's very skeptical of this point? So, for example, if I said, well, you know, if you look at the Muslim countries, you know, the level of morality is quite appalling, oppression of women, as I mentioned before, you know, a lot of crime, a lot of corruption, you know, these corrupt rulers are, you know, the sons of the people. So, you know, Saddam Hussein was from amongst the people, you know, and he's very corrupt. So, you know, to say that it's somebody else's problem that's been imposed on us, you need to be able to demonstrate, you know, how you can competently govern, you know, a country, for example. Is there any historical precedent where, you know, the Muslims were competently able to govern their societies in a way that, you know, even minorities such as non-Muslims who were living amongst the Islamic lands felt comfortable and safe and secure and not discriminated against? Can you bring some historical precedent to substantiate your claim?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Islamic history is dominated by the Khilafah. The Khilafah is the governing structure of Islam, and it dominates Islamic history. So what you find is, throughout history, on many occasions, Muslims were the minorities in the societies they ruled. We find that, for example, during the Inquisition, many of the Jews, they went to Istanbul, which was the seat of the Khilafah at the time, and the descendants of those Jewish communities are still there today. We find when the Muslims ruled over Spain, and many Western historians have written about the justice and the manner in which the Muslims ruled over Muslims and non-Muslims, that didn't actually differentiate between them. So we have, and, you know, many scholars have written books upon books upon the Islamic system of governance, and there are scholars who are famous for the work that they've actually done on this topic. So, yeah, Islam has, we have a president, we have a template to actually rule. Based upon that, we can develop and construct policies for the modern time, and we are not starting from scratch, really. Muslims have ruled in the past, and we were a world power in the past as well. Therefore, we are more than capable and have the ability to actually rule and rule with justice and rule in a way where our societies will develop, and our history actually shows that.
Okay, so what you're saying is there is a historical precedent to the Muslim world being able to manage its own affairs in a way which sort of like scores highly on all the sort of KPIs that were mentioned in this particular book, such as, you know, job creation, law and order, you know, rights for minorities, economic growth or GDP, if you like, you know, security, shelter, you know, all the basic things that a human being would want to live in any society which are in some respects, quite universal. So what you're saying is there is a historical precedent. So just take an example of, say, and also you said earlier that is the impression I got from your answer was what you're saying is Islam is timeless in the sense that it doesn't become obsolete. There is scope for continual advancement in industry, in science, in technology, but some of the key sort of like guidelines or frameworks surrounding, you know, political structures and economic solutions stand the test of time. So take, for example, the recent credit crunch, very complex economic scenario, various factors that cause, you know, free markets. You know, are you saying that Islam can contribute to this discussion?
Oh, absolutely, Islam can. And I believe Islam, to some extent, already is. There's been a discussion for some time now of why the banks that primarily engage in Sharia products have not been affected to the extent of many other banks. I mean, fundamentally, just going to the credit crunch, is that what you find is the very basis of their financial system. It believes in developing new products, and what you find is a financial industry. It developed dubious financial products such as CDLs, credit default swaps, where really none of these products are actual physical goods. Really, what you're doing, you're betting on the movement of interest rates. You're betting on the movement of house prices, as an example, and these sort of products really they drove the development that we saw, or the boom of the last decade. And what you find is these sort of dubious products will always crash in the end, because they're not actually built upon anything tangible. The Islamic economy, on the other hand, as an example, it really only has the real economy. We don't have a parallel economy where people are conducting financial deals on what will happen in the real economy, or whether the agriculture, the harvest will be very good this year or not. What you find is our economy is built upon the real economy. So all citizens participate in manufacturing. They all get engaged in employment, or they all are involved in a business. We don't have this parallel economy where people are betting and speculating on what will actually happen in the actual economy. So what you find, because of this, our economy is much more stable. Because the only way to actually make money is you physically engage in activity. You're not making bets. You're not speculating. And this is a fundamental distinction between the Islamic economy and what you find, the free market economy. And what you find is, I mean, this point about dubious financial products, many free marketeers who for long defended free markets, really they're coming around to this idea now that this free market economy where you can just develop financial products really causes the free market economy to regularly just destruct. And really, especially in the financial crisis, Islamic economics really has a role to play, and really it sits there as an alternative.
But, I mean, people who are critical of the free market, it sort of like sends a message that, you know, you want a socialist type of setup where, you know, the free market is squashed to the point of oblivion, everything is really state-owned. Is that the model that Islam projects? Because, you know, obviously free market has a huge scope and had a huge contribution to the sort of like exponential amount of, you know, growth in GDP as compared with previous centuries where, you know, capital was constrained. What's your understanding of free market from an Islamic perspective?
Okay, I mean, probably more important, Islamic economy is fundamentally different to the socialist or communist economy. We don't believe in unrestricted free markets. On the other hand, we don't believe in the state controlling absolutely everything. The Islamic economy really, in a way you could say, balances both. We believe all the minerals or resources which are key to society, things such as water, things such as electricity, then these should not be actually owned by private individuals. These should be owned collectively by society, so the state administers them and it ensures they're made available to the public. Besides these key minerals or these public properties, really people are free to buy and sell. Anybody is free to set up a business and satisfy any demand that exists in the economy. So in a way, you could say that is an area where there is a free market. However, as we have seen, it was a free market that led to the creation of these devious products that have led to the current recession that we're in. So, you know, free marketeers, they keep arguing that if you, I mean, this is the argument, if you handcuff the financial industry, if you become socialist, then what you'll find is they won't be able to innovate and society cannot move forward. However, we've seen that their innovation is what actually led to the crisis in the first place. On the other hand, if the state controls everything, there's issues of efficiency and inefficiency. So really, Islam really takes, the, you could say, in a way, the middle ground. Key public properties, the state will actually administer them. These are not owned by individuals. Aside from that, people are free to actually engage in trade and fulfill any demand in the economy.
Right, okay. Okay, that's an example from the economic side. Just to touch on the political side, obviously here in the West, you know, there's been a historical, if you like, a medieval feudal period where religion was quite dominant force in society. And, you know, a lot of the oppression was done in the name of religion. And religion creates an environment where, you know, you can't really challenge anything because it's, if you're challenging anything, you know, you're told, you know, this is against God's will, as happened, you know, in the Western, in Western Europe during the run-up to the sort of like the Enlightenment period where, you know, religion was sectioned off to the four walls of the church and, you know, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's and render unto God what is God's. The secular creed, if you like, was born where, you know, religion should have no say. So one could argue, you know, in this model that you're depicting of a state functioning along Islamic lines where, you know, it's not averse to women, it's not averse to, you know, scientific and technological advancement. You know, it's got a unique third way approach to economy. All of this rests on the assumption that the governments will implement these rules as a, and not start to abuse power. What sort of like safety mechanisms exist, because in the democratic model, if a government goes too much after the corporate interest, you know, after 5 years they'll be elected out of power. What safeguard mechanisms exist in this caliphate sort of society that you're painting to prevent the likelihood of something like this happening?
I mean, there's fundamentally two. I mean, I suppose in any society you fundamentally have one, which is political parties. Political parties are, you know, essentially groupings established by the people who understand the society's values, and really they hold to task the ruler or the ruling party when they deviate from this. So in Islam, it is actually obligatory to have one political party, but it is sunnah, it's recommended to have many political parties that can hold the ruler to account. But probably more critically, we actually have a section of the judicial system which focuses entirely upon the ruler or the government in power at the time. And really, the job of this judge is to essentially handle the complaints or the issues raised by political parties or the people with regard to the ruler. So the ruler has contradicted Islam, which are the values of society, and the ruler can actually be removed from the actual position. But really the fundamental check in any society really is the people. And this is where, you know, Islam, it makes it obligatory for Muslims to engage in politics. This is fundamentally politics. It is accounting the ruler and bringing the ruler to task. So what you find, for Muslims, the motivation will be Islam itself. What you find in the West currently at the moment, people are disillusioned with the system. People are finding the expensive scandal. They're finding unless you have a big corporation backing you, really you have no say. And what you find in Islam is the motivation to engage in politics comes from the deen itself. It comes from the same basis which obligates men and women to pray. From the same basis you find that Islam has obligated Muslims to actually engage in politics. So fundamentally, politics is something enshrined in Islam, and this will be the motivation to bring the ruler to task and to hold him accountable. So anybody that actually gets into a position of power has to bear in mind he has 1 billion people monitoring him, monitoring his every move.
Right, so what you're saying is there is an order to bring into being at least one political party, which is, if you like, keeping the leader on his toes and ensuring that there is no deviation from the core values. Another point one could argue is, you know, in this model you're painting, there is no role for the mind, whereas, you know, in the democratic approach, you know, the mind is liberated and allowed to explore avenues that were, you know, beyond bounds during the sort of like feudal system where, you know, they were pigeonholed and oppressed. What does Islam say about the role of the mind? Because obviously you've spoken about the role of the legislation which was revealed to the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. So what is the role of the mind? Will this produce a society, you know, a very sheepish society, or will people still have some scope to use their minds?
I mean, it's an argument many liberals bring up. And there's a reason why they raise this, is because there's a specific narrative that the West has. The West underwent a lengthy period where they struggled with the church, who forced biblical thought upon the people, even when it contradicted the reality. And what you find is they view science, they view development, and they view every other religion actually from this perspective, that if you restrict your thinking to a text, then really you're no different to the church. And really what you find is that's their narrative, it's their history. It's not the history of the world. If you when you look at Islam, what you find is there is a role for the mind. The Islamic belief can only be adopted with the use of the mind. We find even when it comes to implementing the Sharia rules, the role of the mind is to understand the text to ensure it's applied upon the correct reality. But even to apply the text, you need to understand the problem at hand so you can derive and extract the right solution. We find even when we come across new problems, there's a role of the mind. In the area of ijtihad, the mind has to be utilized to actually understand the reality that you face in front of you. So Islamic society most definitely isn't sheepish. In the scientific area, really, the Islamic texts have just pushed mankind to understand Allah's creations, to experiment in what Allah's created, and really to come forward with conclusions in regards to Allah's creations. Really, so what you find in Islamic texts, rather than being prescriptive, it's really just said that Allah's created the universe around you, He subjected them to laws, and really, Muslims should actually push themselves to understand these rules because it will strengthen their actual belief. So what you find is, unlike Christianity and biblical thought, Islam is actually, it pushes the Ummah to use the mind and to understand what Allah has actually created.
So let me just understand what you're saying is that you have to use your mind in order to even embrace the Islamic belief. Is that
absolutely
what you're saying?
We're not like, for example, you know, Islam doesn't believe in a leap of faith where you just blindly follow. The Islamic belief, the Islamic aqidah itself, is built upon the mind, and in fact, it's a condition that the Islamic belief is adopted through the use of the mind and not through blind faith.
Right, okay. I mean, some would argue that, you know, the only knowledge which is credible is scientific knowledge, and science is based on experimentation and direct sensation with your senses, and you can never sense the existence of an afterlife or the existence of, you know, some supreme being. Do you want to just briefly comment on that?
Yeah, I mean, we need to understand, I mean, again, this really is a narrative, again, that the West went through, which is they abandoned biblical thought and they moved over to science. And really what they've done is they've taken science into every realm possible, even where it's not applicable. Now, we need to understand that science can only experiment with the tangible. So, for example, a science cannot prove that the mind exists because the mind is intangible. And this is that's why the realm of science is experimentation. As a result of that, you get technological and industrial development. Really, you know, the key thing really to understand is that science itself is limited, and it's only limited to the tangible items. When it comes to the non-tangible items, such as where did the world even come from, science can't actually answer that. Where would you begin? And really, beyond that sphere, science isn't really applicable. And that's why you find that until today, scientists are still trying to prove that God doesn't exist through the theory of evolution. And evolution has many holes in it. And really, it's down to, you know, science, people who believe in these ideas need to actually prove to Muslims, as an example, that that is actually the case. But, you know, Islam puts science in its right sphere, which is it's to do with the tangible things. So we experiment with them and we understand them. When it comes to areas to do with intangible items, really, this is the area of the mind. This is the realm of the mind, where you sense things around you and you come to conclusions. Therefore, that's really the way Islam views things.
Right. Just to remind our listeners, this is the Today's World show for Radio Ramadan. We're discussing this very large and complex question, which is why is the Muslim world backward and has not progressed as the Western world has progressed in terms of economic, scientific, technological advancement. We're with Adnan Khan, who's a thinker and writer, activist on a lot of these economic, political issues which affect the Muslim world. And the thread of his argument is this is a combination of internal and external factors which are behind the Muslim world's backwardness. External factors, he's looking at things like colonial influences, the fact that the rulers that are imposed upon the Muslim world do not have the blessing, if we can use that word, of the people, of the population. They are imposed by force. There is no right to elect rulers that are compatible with the people's values and aspirations. And even when elections do take place, they are just sham elections, and there is an absolute lack of choice behind, when the first Ford car was produced, any color as long as it's black. That's the type of scenario we have. And coupled with other factors which are primarily internal, intellectual decline, culture overriding religious understanding, a very weakened understanding since the demise of the golden era of Islamic rule, where a system which he refers to as the caliphate system existed, which he's also saying does not exist anywhere in the world today, despite the fact that we have governments who claim in their naming to be Islamic, such as Saudi Arabia, Iran, and I guess included in that is regimes or governments like the Taliban government, which was very keen in projecting that we are the correct followers of Islam. Then he's also spoken about some of the safeguards that exist within the Islamic political structures and also within the society in the form of political parties, which will safeguard against any sort of variation against this model of governance, which is shaped along the basis of Islam. So, Adnan, I guess what you're saying is, to do a like-for-like comparison, Islam is not really a religion as is understood, here in the West, where religion is just a personal relationship, where, once a week or in the evening you can say a little prayer, or it gets, you through the difficulty of life if you've got something to fall back to. It's actually more of a alternative to, capitalism or, the democratic model, or communism for that matter, than a religion. Is that a good summation of the crux of your argument?
Yeah, absolutely. Islam is a comprehensive system. It provides the solutions for the economy, provides solutions for the social system, for men and women and how they should conduct themselves in society, and it provides a comprehensive system really for people to form a society and really move forward and develop.
And also in terms of certain observations that we quoted Bernard Lewis, who's a famous historian, in a book he wrote a few years ago, which was What Went Wrong. And clearly in this title, you can see what he's alluding to, which is that there was a period of a certain elevation within the Middle East, for example, his particular focus of study, between the past and the present, where you've seen very low literacy rates, you see very low levels of, you know, healthcare provision, of economic development, job creation. I mean, he says the Arab world translates about 330 books annually, one-fifth of the number that Greece translates. You know, he says the GDP of the Arab world is less than that of Spain. These are shocking statistics for anyone who's, you know, following the sort of like performance of the indicators of the Middle East. And what we're saying is, you know, his, what you're saying is his understanding is not sound, and there is actually a sort of like alternative vision which needs to be brought into being in the Muslim world. Can I ask then, is there any backing to this particular vision that you have, or is this a very marginal view, and most of the people are looking for some other forms of modernization which is outside of the scope of this vision? Is this a marginal view, and or is this a mainstream view? And if it's a mainstream view, how is it possible for, you know, a few, the minority, the ruling factions, for example, to suppress the people if this is their overriding and overwhelming desire? Surely, you know, in the prior to the Renaissance and the French Revolution and all of these times where there was a feudal system, the people overthrew the bourgeoisie was overthrown by the proletariat. And, you know, this situation cannot be allowed to sustain itself. Is this, you know, a mainstream view, I suppose, is the crux of the question?
I mean, I think you'll find even many Western think tanks, they've clearly highlighted that the call for Khilafah, the call for reunification of the wider Muslim world, the call for Sharia in the last decade has really grown to the point where, you know, the West have to sit up and actually take notice that the Muslims have an alternative view of their societies. And really we're at a stage now where really the only obstacle is the Muslim rulers, who really are just, they're just an architecture of colonialism. And really they are the only things holding the Muslim world back from what they actually want to achieve. And that's why you find the Muslim rulers have utilized the security services, they've utilized the armies to really quell any dissent and any move towards alternative governance. And really, you know, for you know, Muslims really have had enough. You find that many of the Muslim rulers are having to go to extremes now to maintain their actual positions. And, you know, many of them, their relationship with the West has been exposed. Especially recently we saw with Israel's aggression in the Gaza Strip really exposed many of the Arab rulers and their relationship with the West. And really, many think tanks have hit the nail on the head, which is that the Muslim world, they actually have an alternative view on their societies. They don't actually want to be democratic. And when I mean, say, democracy, I mean in the sense of secular values, freedom. And really, what we're finding is the minority who the West managed to dupe into their values really are finding that the masses really are pushing for this alternative view.
Right. I mean, we need to start wrapping up. So just before I ask you to summarize, just to ask you a few questions. These views you're expressing, obviously, you've expressed your opinion. How would you, if you went to the Muslim world, would you be able to express these opinions? And if not, how do you feel about that?
I mean, as I'm sure most people in the Muslim world would know, you can't express these views. In fact, even the Labour Party, if they express their views in the Muslim world, they'll be locked up. For good. The Muslim rulers don't allow any discussion. I mean, that's how weak their position is they can't even debate or engage in any sort of discussion. And, you know, really, that really just shows you how weak they are. And I think the more desperate they get, it really shows you that the end is near for them.
I can share some of those sentiments. I remember once I was in a economic seminar in Pakistan, and the finance minister was there, and I had some questions, and I could see, you know, the intelligence were really looking at me, and as if to say, you know, if you ask any difficult questions, you know, we're gonna follow you to your hotel. So, you know, I can sort of like concur with that sort of frustration, and it is a frustration because, you know, I'm sure. I mean, from my reading of the Islamic civilization in the past, there was, you know, expression was permitted. I mean, sometimes, you know, we talk about freedom of speech. Freedom is always within a context. I mean, we can sit here and discuss views within the context of freedom. And even in the Islamic society, you know, you can discuss views within a context also. But it's obviously when the views start to go to the borders of the civilization and the sort of like the parameters of the civilization, at that point, you know, there will be restriction. So, you know, but to have the scenario, as you say, in the Muslim world where, you know, any type of accountability, any type of questioning of, you know, why did our government, you know, take this particular project, or why did they borrow this money from the World Bank to build, you know, this particular project, how is this a cost-effective project, any type of accountability such as this will be met with, you know, hostility and danger. Your life will practically be in danger. And that is a very shocking an indictment on the Muslim world, given the fact that there's such, as you say, abundance of resources, such human resource, you know, over 1.3 or 4 billion people, you know, women, they're allowed to work, and all of this is cultural subversion, which is, you know, Islam gets a bad name for that, because countries like Saudi, unless you know otherwise, you're going to see that country as being a beacon of Islam. And, you know, if it's official law that women can't even drive a car, you know, can't even be seen in public, then, you know, that's really, that sends a damning message as to, you know, the type of society which is an alternative to, you know, the society we have here. So, obviously, you know, we've raised many issues, and perhaps some of the questions people have had, you know, have been satisfied. Maybe it's opened up more questions. Do you want to just sort of like conclude by just summing up what are the key sort of like tenets of your argument in the next few minutes?
Yeah, the key thing to understand is our situation isn't entirely due to us. There are a number of external factors, primarily colonialism, international institutes, and agent rulers. And really, until we don't deconstruct these and remove these, we will not become independent, and we will not be able to implement Islam. So the vision I present is we need to remove our rulers, who are really a product of colonialism, take control of our societies, and really then appoint rulers who represent the values we want to see in society, and inshallah from there we can actually move forward and apply Islam, which has a track record of providing success and development.
Okay, Jazakallah, thank you, Adnan, for expressing your views, and hopefully I've sort of like presented a balanced view and posed some of the questions which, you know, many people may have towards some of your arguments. You've been listening to the Today's World Show on Radio Ramadan, 87.7 FM. I'd like to thank you for joining us, and hopefully you've benefited from the discussion, and it's given you a little more insight into some of the motivations and sort of like thinking behind some of the movements which are now coming in the Muslim world, which are, you know, calling for an alternative vision to radically sort of change the abyss that we have in the Muslim world, because obviously it cannot carry on like this. You know, something, you know, even if you're not somebody who comes from a religious basis, you know, even non-Muslims living in the Muslim world, you know, feel frustrated and agitated by the lack of, you know, accountability, the lack of progression, the lack of opportunity, despite, like I said, the abundance of resources, the abundance of human population, the you know, the natural irrigation through Egypt, you know, the minerals and all of these, you know, basic ingredients that define a nation that can become very powerful and progressive in the modern world. yet we, as you say, you know, have such a abysmal track record. So just to remind you, this is a show which is held every day after the fast opens at 9:30. It's Today's World Show on 87.7 FM. I'd like to wish all of you a nice evening, and Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.